Well, hello there. Who are you?
This is the Zodiac speaking.
Killing must feel good to God, too. He does it all the time. And are we not created in his image?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
After all, murder is, or should be, an art.
I could kill you now pretty easily. Do some interesting things before anyone showed up.
What are these films you can't wait to look at?
Welcome to the Final Girls Podcast and the second episode of our series dedicated to on-screen serial killers from the silent to the Marvel era. I'm Anna Bogutska, your podcast host and the natural Hitchcock brunette. I'm joined by film critic and friend of the pod, Leila Lateef, to discuss three Alfred Hitchcock films that have serial killers at their core. Not that one. In this episode, we're talking about Shadow of a Doubt from 1943, a portrait of a misogynistic serial killer and his weirdly close relationship with his niece, 1948's Rope, the gayest film that Hitchcock ever made, inspired by the real-life murder committed by rich boy idiots Leopold and Loeb, and we finish off our discussion talking about the nastiest one of the bunch, Frenzy from 1972, a particularly gruesome portrait of a London-based serial killer. Word of warning, we spoil all the films and we get a little deep in this episode because watching these three films together is truly walking a very intense mental tightrope that might plunge you into existential despair. And on that note, if you enjoyed this episode, do leave the podcast a review over in Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can see what other films I'm going to be discussing in the series over on our Letterboxd page, and you can find The Final Girls on Instagram and what used to be Twitter and now is just hell.
Always a pleasure and that to fluffy have you back, note, Leila.
Even if it is to talk about murderers. On three
such
of Alfred Hitchcock's serial killers.
Particularly to talk about murderers.
So before we dig into the three films that we're going to chat about today, I wanted to ask you a couple of general murder-adjacent questions. Did you have your own serial killer phase when you were younger?
I don't think I did, which seems like incredibly not on brand.
Yeah, very off brand for you.
Yeah. No, I was never particularly into like the real life serial killers because I always found that like the more I'd learn about them, the more it was kind of way less exciting than the movies. I think when you sort of started out with your Hannibal Lecters, when you get into a Ted Bundy in terms of, you know, a real life serial killer, the truth is actually just pretty pedestrian and depressing. So I stayed very much in the sort of world of fantasy when it came to them. You know, when I was a big slasher movie kid, and like most of the time that killer changes with each one, like, you know, who is going to be tormenting Neve Campbell rather than like a continued person doing it every time. Yeah, I was much more into the final girl than I was into the killer themselves.
Yeah, or doesn't speak at all and is genuinely just a bulky man with a mask.
Yeah, as they tend to be. I mean, I think a lot of the time good Lord, we could do a whole podcast on this. Like, I think there's a sort of romanticization and like the idea of the genius serial killer, which in part is down to Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, 100%.
But generally when you get into them, they're pretty disappointing. And I think a lot of them's reputations have been made to kind of suggest that they were kind of much more kind of elegant, brilliant figures. It tends to just be horrible brutes.
And what do you think of when you think of serial killers at the movies?
I mean, to me, it is, not to kind of just keep repeating myself, but to me, it is so Hannibal Lecter. I absolutely, you know, adore those books, adore those films. I mean, like, you know, I'm not deranged. I do appreciate Hannibal is terrible, but the rest, you know, as a film and as a text. But like the kind of idea of somebody that's got like an artistry to them always really appealed to me. I think it was that, and it was David Fincher's Seven.
Yes.
Like I liked a serial killer with creativity.
Yeah, and with a plan. You know, he's got, I love a serial killer that's almost a project manager, you know, that he's got a timeline, he's got deranged notebooks, or in the digital age, that might be like a really insane notion where he's planned out everything, how he's going to do it. I like the attention to detail in Seven and in Hannibal as well.
And I think that these people kind of gain a level of affection with us because, you know, I'm reminded of something that I read about. Vince Gilligan said about the characters of Breaking Bad, where when it comes to Saul, when it comes to Walter White, people can stay on side with them because people fundamentally want to see people who are very good at their jobs.
Yes.
And I think there's just a competence to a Hannibal Lecter and to a degree to a Jigsaw killer where it's just like, you know, you can see that what they're doing is terrible, but you appreciate this kind of time management.
You appreciate the craft in a way.
You appreciate the craft. There's, yeah. You know, it's a tricky thing to kind of, you know, I struggle to get like six mates together for dinner. And, you know, there is some true, there are some lessons that we can take from these thankfully fictional people.
So before we get into the individual films that we're talking about, and I'm very aware that there's two very core serial killer texts from Alfred Hitchcock that are missing from this episode, but that is by design. I wanted to ask you about your own relationship with the cinema of Hitchcock. Kind of where do you stand?
So I came to Hitchcock a lot sooner than I knew about Hitchcock, as, you know, as a person. So I was, I think probably the earliest when I was in Sudan as a child. I went to the British Embassy where they were screening 39 Steps. And then it became much more of the horror genre, you know, Psycho, Frenzy was quite an early one, Adore, Rear Window, Adore, North by Northwest. I feel like a lot of my cinema literacy came from Hitchcock because you're sort of learning about what MacGuffins are. You're learning about what film noir is. Mm-hmm. And personally, I'm not a person, you know, personally, I'm not someone that like a lot of comedy works for. I find very few things funny. In some way, my favorite Hitchcock is The Lady Vanishes, simply because I just so astonished by how much the laughs hold up. So yeah, I'm a great admirer of him. Worked my way through a full Hitchcock box set on many occasions. And I would say that I think The Birds is very overrated and actually sucks. But yes, a huge fan. And in some ways that makes it a little bit more devastating when you get older and you learn that he did a lot of bad things and you have to sort of, you know, pass it in your brain as to how much you can separate the art and the artist.
And in the case of Hitchcock, you know, without getting into a whole debate over, you know, what to do with the art of monstrous men, there's tons of articles and books about that. But there is a lot of obsessions that can be seen in his films that were really, that were on the screen for us to observe. And they become even more apparent if you do a kind of rewatch or a first watch of all his films, especially in kind of chronological as opposed to thematic order.
Yeah, I definitely did kind of watch them in a chronological order. I think I kind of got into, I was doing my like my deep dives on the horror, my deep dives on the thrillers, and then, you know, taking on the comedies. And yeah, because the thought of the sort of themes that occur seem very much to me to be like historically placed. Like when you see the world is in a darker place, his films reflect that. And it's a tricky one. I wonder whether maybe it's a little bit easier because, you know, by the time I watched my first Hitchcock film, he was long dead.
Yeah.
Which gives you a little bit of freedom because it's not like, you know, like, sorry, not to compare this, but like, I really love the R. Kelly song, the remix to Ignition. And I can't listen to that song because there's a sense of like, oh, any click on a YouTube video of it or a Spotify, or if I download it, that's going to like physically be giving him money.
Yeah. Yeah. There's less of that imperative.
Died. Yeah. It's more your own kind of moral purity rather than like a strong sense of like, oh, I must take this out of my life because I cannot support this.
I mean, this entire series is not really one of moral purity, so I think we can leave that at the door, in a sense.
I know. I did have a sad moment the other day, though, where I walked past Gabuska, who was singing the remix to Ignition, and I was just like, oh my God, I've missed it. But no! I mean, talented people and awful people is, a Venn diagram that overlaps.
Well, let's talk about the awful people on the screen. We're going to chat about all these films kind of and how they relate to one another, because they're all concerned with killers. Sometimes very proficient ones and sometimes really measly ones. But starting with Shadow of a Doubt, which I was trying to remember when I was rewatching it, I think might have been my first Hitchcock film that I ever watched as a student. Oh, wow. And it was, I believe, by some accounts, his favorite of his own films. And when I was putting together the list and kind of, you know, you mentioned Hannibal Lecter a lot, and Hannibal is one of the prime examples that we have of not just an original contemporary kind of killer that has become even larger than he was in the movies, the TV show, but he's a very charming kind of sociopath. You know, he has all these things that are covetable while also being utterly deplorable. And I think that Uncle Charlie, the character played by Joseph Cotten in Shadow of a Doubt, is a really, really early example of this sort of charming psychopath. And I was wondering kind of how do you feel about his appeal in the movie and the way that Cotten portrays him?
It's strange because I feel like it's changed so much since, I mean, the first time I rewatched for the podcast, and it's the first time I've seen it for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I was younger, I was very sort of caught up in like this enigmatic, seductive figure and like, you know, how sophisticated he seems and like, oh, you know, a bit, you know, you couldn't possibly imagine such a person like this is like that. And I believe that now, in this like, maybe having dated, maybe just being aware of sort of intersectional feminism, maybe I found him deeply pathetic from the off.
Oh.
To me, he seemed like an Andrew Tate figure, like that very like superficial charm. Mm. And when he kind of does his, you know, monologue. Famous final monologue.
Yeah.
Which, Anna, I would ask, could you read out? Because I would love to hear it. But
you want to hear it in my voice? I mean?
That felt so... Yes, no, I would.
I will look it up now. Excuse the typing.
But you know what I mean? There's something much more pitiful to him than I saw before. I think earlier on, he seemed to be like in a position of like power, somebody who's almost like enacting like a righteous vengeance upon these people that he finds wanting, you know, these people that he finds inadequate. And now it was very interesting to come back to it, you know, as a geriatric millennial and uncover that, like, this is the sort of man who is only impressive and is to someone like young Charlie, his niece.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a window for which that, you know, that this kind of, that this feels like a kind of genius poet. I think as you get older, you're just like, oh, this is just a deeply depressing, pathetic human in the way that so the world is filled with similar people. This just happens to be a violent one.
Yeah. And it's interesting you mentioned that, because there is, I think there is a reason why, you know, we're kind of charmed by even the idea of a serial killer, particularly if you do, you know, you didn't. But for the ones of us who go through this phase, particularly as teenagers, of kind of being interested in these figures that seem so far away, not charming, but almost otherworldly in their evil and their violence, right? Because it is a very, not that serial killers were only American, but it does feel in the way that the ones that have kind of penetrated into the mainstream kind of killer canon, and the way the ones that have been adapted onto or inspired other psychopaths on screen have mostly been American. There is this image of them as being larger than life. And as I've been rewatching these movies, including Shadow of a Doubt, that charm is non-existent. And there are quite pathetic characters, and they're played as such. But I think you're right. A lot of the movie is seen until later on through Charlie's eyes. So young Charlie's eyes. And the way that she sees her own connection to her uncle is almost like her starting to discover kind of that darkness in and of herself, that darkness that seems to be appealing to her. But as soon as she starts suspecting him, that charm is revealed to be really, really flimsy. And I don't know if you think that Cotton was playing it kind of knowingly, because it is, it is of a time, so it's moralistic in the way that any evil has to be punished and any evil has to be abhorrent. And we don't really see Uncle Charlie commit the murders that he's guilty of, but we know, we understand what the motivation for them is. And there is this like sense of darkness to him that as soon as you see it, as soon as you know that that's who he is, that there is, it's beyond a shadow of a doubt to, you know, as the title suggests, the charm kind of evaporates. So it's a weird film to rewatch, because once you know, you cannot look at him in the same way. You cannot look at him through those kind of young Charlie eyes.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. In a way, it's a coming-of-age film.
Totally.
In the sort of most classic sense of the world, where it's like your illusions about the world around you are being stripped off. And that, to me, makes sense for the sort of film that Hitchcock was making in 1943, because, like, this was, you know, obviously the middle of the Second World War, and the whole world is going through a sort of reevaluation of what surrounds them
and what does evil look like,
and how sort of evil could look very familiar,
mm-hmm.
and look quite close to, like, you know, this, you know, the people that were warring, the people that, you know, the British and the Americans, you know, Hitchcock was British, but at the time he was living in America, are fighting in World War II, and not like foreign and disquieting in like the same way. We're talking about people that they've kind of probably have a shared, you know, a sense of a shared history and a shared culture with. And so for that to be the ultimate evil all of a sudden is, I can imagine how much that would like throw you off your course. But still watching this, I gotta say, for a second time, the thing I was almost most reminded of is, like, do you remember the moment where you discovered that Ted Bundy isn't actually hot?
Do you know what? I actually have a weird one with that, because I think I saw pictures of him before I was exposed to the narrative of Ted Bundy was hot and that's how he managed to convince women to go with him and help him out. And I was like, he really wasn't. How did this get started? Is the bar that low physically for serial killers? I mean, it is. It really is.
Sure. But I mean, like, the way that people talk about Ted Bundy, you would expect like David Gandhi's Dolce & Gabbana ad to be like what was being presented in court. And there's something so strange about it. It's like this idea that we have to view we have to so emphasize the charms, and we have to kind of, you know, like be like, oh, but you know, who could resist? And it's like, yeah, watching this again, I was just like, yeah, Charlie is a red flag from minute one. Well, and Ted Bundy was not hot.
Well, there is something interesting there, right? Because, and I think you mentioned it earlier, but it's in the context of Hitchcock's career, this is also his first truly American movie that's mm-hmm. set in America. And I wonder if this has to do with it as well, because in this small town, Santa Rosa, right, I think it's called, where the narrative is set, Uncle Charlie is an exotic kind of visitor. You know, when he comes in, it's possibly the most exciting thing that's happened to that family and that town in a while. So I think that charm that seems kind of so unbelievable is wrapped up in this idea of, well, if nothing happens around here and this tall stranger comes through, that's by default charming. And I wonder if you have thoughts about kind of how Hitchcock portrays this idea of idyllic Americana that gets perverted by this exterior force.
What's that? An idyllic Americana? Well, there's a rot in their foundations. I've never heard of such a thing. Yeah, it's a tricky thing because I think as much as I'm not American, I've spent some time in America, but not a ton. I'm still like my view of America is like my view of America from the movies.
Yeah.
And so I think I'm coming to any depiction of America with a slight confusion as to what their values are. And I think maybe what I relate to with Hitchcock in this film is that there's the idea of like America as being like slightly puzzling. Mm-hmm. Like there's a quaintness to it, but there's like a astonishingly dark, sinister underbelly. Like the relation, like everything's slightly off.
Mm-hmm.
In like his version of Americana, and to me it makes sense that he's coming into it not just as a person who's in like, you know, mid World War II trying to make sense of everything, but also just in this new landscape trying to get what the real foundation of this place is. England has got such a sort of strong sense of itself, for better, for worse. I mean, I would say largely for worse. Like the idea of like what America was so like in flux for such a long time. And I think you still see that in America today, where there's idea of like, what is the real America? What are real American values and stuff? And I think what he's picking up is like almost like the uncertainty. Like they're excited about the new, but also keep it away. Mm-hmm. Maybe it kills you.
And before I touch on the monologue again and Uncle Charlie's motivations, where does this film kind of sit within the work but also the life of Hitchcock?
I mean, like he was established at this point. The 39 Steps had done brilliantly. The all-time laugh riot of The Lady Vanishes had done terribly well. It's strange to imagine that this was like an era where people were just putting out so many films. So I mean, we're at a point where he's kind of like pretty much doing one a year, and many of them are masterpieces. But we've headed past, yeah, so this is definitely post Rebecca.
Yes.
And post-Suspicion. But to me, this seems to be a turn for Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
And my assumption is always that it's the environment of the time, the place he was in his life, where this seems to be the this is a tip into despair that would, you know, be common in many of his later films, particularly actually in the films that we're going to go on to talk about.
Hmm.
But I think this is the moment where he actually embraces a true kind of like darkness of humanity.
That darkness is really, I mean, it's embodied by Uncle Charlie, by Cotton's performance, the way that the motif of smoke keeps coming up everywhere, like he's this dark cloud that appears and is, you know, at risk of consuming everyone around him. But especially this monologue, you know, you echo Andrew Tate and that kind of ilk of professional misogynist. But even though it's incredibly scripted, there is a chillingness to the way that he delivers that monologue, where he is in plain language and in plain sight of his family, explaining, really revealing the depth of his hatred for the women he selects to kill. It's not really motivated by money, even though, you know, he's gaining all their money. But what do you make of that moment and the way that he, you know, does this really extreme close-up on Cotton's face as he delivers those lines?
Yeah, I would say in terms of Cotton, phenomenal actor. Obviously, I think this is probably the best scene of his career. You can sort of, it's almost like watching a person being possessed.
Hmm.
But maybe it's more sort of an unveiling. Anna, I need to hear you read the monologue, because it's just, I mean, people talk about the Norman Bates one. This is Hitchcock's best killer monologue. We got to hear it.
I'm going to read it, but in the edit, I will change my voice to Cotton's, because no one could do this man justice.
I'm excited to hear you read it. I think it'll be so different hearing it from a woman's voice. I'm very excited.
Yeah. Do you want me to go full Cotton?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. The cities are full of women, middle-aged widows, husbands dead, husbands who spend their lives making fortunes, working and working, and then they die and they leave their money to their wives, their silly wives.
What do the wives do, these useless women? You see them in the hotels, the best hotels, every day by the thousands. Drinking the money, eating the money, losing the money at bridge, playing all day and all night, smelling of money. Proud of their jewelry, but of nothing else. Horrible. Faded, fat, greedy women.
But they're alive, they're human beings.
Are they?
Are they, Charlie? Are they human, or are they fat, wheezing animals? Hmm? What happens to animals when they get too fat and too old?
I did not enjoy that. I did not enjoy that.
No, nor should you. But I mean, that's the incredible thing. It's just, it loses none of its power.
It really is.
It's so foul, because I think it's a threat of violence that, like, women, non-binary people, you know, all just live with. So much. He's tapping into something which is so darkly and horrifically true.
And there's this thing of in the film, and there's this moment in the video that I put together for the series, where he turns to the camera, where he's actually turning to Charlie, and she says, but they're alive, they're human beings. And he just almost looks directly at camera and says, are they? Are they, though? There is such a disdain. And he mentions money, money, money in the monologue, but it's not about money. It really isn't. Not at all.
No. It made me think a little bit of watching it this time of, like, what, you know, Bassem Youssef said recently about how when you label people rats, you don't care what happens to them. And, like, this whole thing of, like, it's not enough to sort of perpetuate violence against women. It's not enough to be a sadistic serial killer. You have to make them subhuman.
Yeah.
And then we can all, I don't know, not care what happens to them, I suppose.
Well, yeah, it allows you to maintain a kind of moral high ground, because you're not actually killing or hurting another person. You're killing rats or animals, like he describes them in this monologue, in this scene.
Andrew Tate Andrew Tate demanding a sandwich of a woman is just, you know, like getting a dog to fetch a ball.
Yeah. And it's the same vibe as the thread that exists in Rope, you know? You know, to segue into that next film, that is what I think connects both Shadow of a Doubt, Rope, and Frenzy. And Frenzy is a much nastier film that we'll come to in a bit, but Rope also has this very slightly satirical speech, because it is delivered by the Jimmy Stewart character. Mm-hmm. But what it's concerned with is this idea that these two guys, very famously based on Leopold and Loeb, who were two very young, college-age rich boys who were obsessed with Nietzsche's writings, badly interpreted them in a way that flattered them as superior beings that should be allowed to and would, of course, undoubtedly be able to get away with murder, even though it wouldn't even be murder because they were committing it and they were above the person that they decided to kill, who was another young boy. And we see that in the film with the famous The Art of Murder speech and the kind of the right to murder of some people. And I was wondering kind of what do you think about this film, particularly since it dispenses with suspense from the very first moment. The first scene we get is the murder and we know exactly who did it. We know where the body's hidden. And then the rest of the movie unfolds. So where's the tension for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a film that's often sort of dismissed as a, like, filmmaking exercise. Mm. It's presented, obviously, as all one shot. There's some sort of movie magic in that. I think it was maybe,
I think,
three, four shots at the time. But
I think it's like eight shots, and the cuts are very clean and very visible.
Yeah. But, you know, the camera isn't that dynamic, so it doesn't, to me, readers like, oh my goodness, the magic of the movies, because it's a little bit like you're watching a sort of staged play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, someone like James Stewart, John Dole, Farley Granger, like these are stars of stage and screen. So it's like, I think that maybe initially may have been sort of the thing that people were so impressed by, but watching it now, that is somewhat died. And I believe that you're right. What's more interesting is, particularly in our era of true crime brain, of the idea that, like, we might all be ingenious enough to pull off the perfect murder. Mm-hmm. And this did remind me of something that I saw, admit for my shame, on TikTok, where they said that, you know, fundamentally every man believes he could beat Serena Williams. Sorry, every straight man believes he could beat Serena Williams in a tennis match. Every gay man believes that he could win Drag Race. And every woman believes she could pull off the perfect murder. And I was watching this being just like, well, these people have made mistakes, but I still think I have it in me. I'm not gonna, but I just want listeners to know that I could.
I think all women could, you know.
Yeah,
but
it's lucky that we don't union. Sorry.
The murder union. Maybe. But there is what I find really interesting is I was listening to a few true crime episodes about Leopold and Loeb, because I'm familiar with their story, but I wanted a refresher before rewatching Rope. So I kind of had them front of mind. And, you know, to echo what we were saying before about Uncle Charlie, about kind of this like sleaziness or kind of pathetic nature of him that becomes revealed almost after you watch the film for the second time, knowing who he is and having that monologue in the back of your mind. There is also, much as the real Leopold and Loeb, where their hubris really stemmed from the fact that they were unbelievably wealthy and their money protected them in a way that I don't think, you know, they fully acknowledge, but that we, I hope that we can kind of understand how much that protected them, both from both at the time of the actual trial, but also in shaping their thinking that they could and should get away with murder. They did a really sloppy job, so they were caught very quickly after they killed a teenage boy. They fully believed that they were in the right. And even in the first kind of interrogation moments when they were caught, didn't even bother asking for a lawyer because they fully believed that they would just be let go, because their families were important and very wealthy. And to the credit of Hitchcock and the actors, you know, and in the movie they're renamed Brandon and Philip, they have that rich boy arrogance that, at least for me, makes them instantly laughable, because they do come across as boys who have gotten their hands real messy and don't even understand what it is that they've done.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like, do you feel that like Jimmy Stewart is this sort of voice of reason, almost like superior intellect that's like coming into this? Do you think that's what exposes the sort of, I know, just like how sickly empathetic these two guys are, because they're pitiful. They're pitiful.
They really are. But I find the Jimmy Stewart character, the mentor character, kind of weird and off-putting in a sense, because he's Jimmy Stewart. He's kind of a Tom Hanks actor, where you never want to see Jimmy Stewart be evil. It kind of would sort of break the Matrix, right? And when he does the monologue about the art of murder, when he starts it, and he's basically pitching the movie The Purge in that monologue in 1948, you know, about this kind of murder week or, you know, strangulation night or something.
Now, you don't really approve of murder, Rupert, if I may.
You may, and I do. Think of the problems it would solve. Unemployment, poverty, standing in line for theater tickets.
I must say I've had a perfectly dreadful time getting tickets for that new musical. What's it called? You know.
The something with what's her name? My dear Mrs. Atwater, careful application of the trigger finger and a pair of seats in the first row is yours for the shooting. And have you had any difficulty in getting into our velvet rope restaurant?
Frightful.
A very simple matter. A flick of the knife, madame. And if you'll kindly step this way. Oh, no, step over the head waiter's body. Thank you. And here's your table.
Rupert, you're the end.
As a hotel clerk, I could cheerfully flick a knife at.
Oh, no, sorry. Knives may not be used on hotel employees. They are in the death by slow torture category.
Oh.
Along with bird lovers, small children, and tap dancers. Landlords, of course, are another matter. You're seeking an apartment? Call on our Miss Sashwaite of the Blunt Instrument Department.
What a divine idea. If it suits your purpose merely. But then we'd all be murdering each other.
Oh, no. Oh, no. After all, murder is, or should be, an art. Not one of the seven lively, perhaps, but an art nevertheless. And as such, the privilege of committing it should be reserved for those few who are really superior individuals.
And the victims, inferior beings whose lives are unimportant anyway.
Obviously.
It always comes off as a joke because you just don't take it seriously. It's always an intellectual exercise. But when he starts realizing what they've actually done inspired by his joking or his theorizing, he becomes very disturbed, and he, you know, is the moral the moral compass, or kind of almost the detective figure in a way. And I was wondering, kind of, what do you think about their, how his presence changes the dynamic between Brendan and Philip in the movie?
I mean, firstly, I'm now terrified that we've done a Jimmy Stewart and just encouraged a lot of female listeners that they could pull off committing the perfect murder.
Do you know what? To quote Lady Gaga, I do not believe in the glorification of violence, but I do believe in the empowerment of women. So you do with that what you will, listeners.
Yeah, I think it sort of kind of speaks to a bit of a sort of a continual, like, generational, a generational fear, where it's just like, oh, we were wild with our ideas, but with our wild ideas, the youth can't actually be trusted with them. But I fully agree with you in terms of there's something so darkly funny about how them trying to commit the perfect murder is so basic. But because of, like, this, like, sense of intense privilege, and because life has been so easy mm-hmm. for everything beforehand, they just half-ass it. It feels like somebody from Eton half-assing a minor role in the cabinet. This may have presented itself to you to be easy, and you may have, like, this, like, incredible legal team that will probably help you get through, like, the worst of what you do. But, like, yeah, there's, like, a sense of that these men are babies, and a little bit in the shadow of the doubt there's also this, like, idea of, like, infantile men, that, like, as much as these are men that we should fear, these are also male characters who are inadequate with dealing with the world, don't want and can't even really consider consequences for their actions or any real sort of responsibility for the things that they do.
And there's also something...
Wait a second, is Hitchcock a feminist? Sorry, I'm joking.
But there is something also, like, really childish about the way that they insist on displaying their mess, you know? It's mm-hmm. like this, like, I'm going to get scatological, so forgive me. It's almost like kids who've pooped in their own hands and want to rub it all over the walls and show it off to you. Like, they insist on hiding the corpse of the boy they've killed in this big trunk. They want it in the middle of the room. They want to serve food off of it. They miss, on purpose or not, the rope kind of dangling outside of it. The John Dahl character, Brandon, wraps these books in the rope that they used to kill the boy to give as a present, or kind of lend the books to another character. Like, there's so much of rubbing everyone's face into what they've done. They're begging to be discovered so that people could appreciate their, you know, supposed perfect murder.
So I always got a sense that I don't know that they even particularly wanted to kill him. What truly sort of is their cup of tea, what tickles their fancy, is the idea of being above it all.
Yeah.
And their entire lives, they've been told that they've been above it all. And in many ways, they have been. I mean, they're not delusional in that way. I think there's probably many, you know, even in the real life case, had, like, they'd taken an hour more care, they probably would have, as very wealthy, you know, white privileged men of the era, gotten away with it. Maybe if they just asked for that lawyer. You know, at the beginning. But it's like there's a, yeah, I guess the hubris is the point. It's almost a bit kinky, isn't it? It's like that you actually just want to test your limits. You want to kind of see how far you can push it.
Well, that's I put this in the questions that I sent to you, but when I was watching it and knowing that there is, I think this is text. I don't think this is subtext. I think this is very deliberately in the film and in the performances. Brandon and Philip are implied to be sexually or romantically involved in some way. And as were the real Leopold and Loeb. But this is, actually, let me phrase that as a question. Is this basically a film about edging?
Isn't everything about edging? Yeah, I think it is a film about edging. Sexually, there's certainly a like kink element at play. They're sort of that they're being titillated, they're being scintillated, they're being turned on by violence, they're being turned on by like fooling people. I think of the same way that like two people, you know, not just edging, but like two people having like a illicit affair. The thrill is in being close to being caught.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's something in that when you're a child, there's a, you know, when you're raising kids, you just get so much about like they're testing their limits, they're testing their boundaries and stuff. And like, imagine like growing up your entire life. And I think basically no woman will be able to imagine this, but like the idea of having no limits, no kind of terrible behavior that will necessarily like exclude you from society. And I think there's that as well. There's a sort of, there's a kinky edging, but there's also a sort of sociopolitical edging.
It's like a moral edging, basically.
Well, it's not even moral though, is it? Because they know what they're doing is wrong. It's just like they're sort of, how immoral can I get before like society says no?
I'm not entirely sure that they know. I think them understanding that what they're doing is wrong is only theoretical. I don't actually think that they perceive it or feel it as wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder as well if, you know, in both in Frenzy and in Shadow of a Doubt, the victims of the killers are all women, and the kind of the drive of the killers is very much a very deep and very angry hatred of women. But here, the one victim of Brandon and Philip is one of their fellow students, another young man. And I wonder if you think that changes the dynamic of the film and whether it changes our perception of the film as well, because we're so used to serial killers targeting women.
I think in a way what it does, or at least like probably because of like everything that I've, you know, ingested around it, is it makes me feel that it wasn't born of hatred, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Which feeds into the themes of the films. Like, I don't think they killed Brandon because they wanted him dead. And that there's a sort of, let's say, had we started off with the horrific, you know, murder of a woman, I think our position would be that, like, oh, there was a, like a passion behind it. As sick as it was, there was kind of like a feeling behind it. But there's something about it being a man who looks like them, who's part of their kind of area of society, that makes it all the sort of mechanical.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's sort of like dispassionate and more intellectual. Like almost like the victim doesn't matter at all.
No. Yeah. Which is not actually how it really like passes out in the real world, because I think that those sort of things are surprisingly rare. And obviously in the real life case, it was somewhat, I believe he was like a preteen.
He was, yeah.
You know, certainly like, so that, you know, that's a significant change. It sort of takes out that level of evil, and it just kind of focuses on like the entitlement of these guys.
And with this film, with Rope, with Shadow of a Doubt, and later on with Psycho, obviously, the killer is very much the center of the film. We spend most of our time as audiences with them. Do you think that Hitchcock's killers, his protagonist killers at least, have anything in common?
Not always. I think Hitchcock is very clear to contextualize his killers within the film, but I think the context of the era keeps changing. So if we're talking about Norman Bates or Frenzy or Rope,
mm-hmm.
or you know, Shadow of the Doubt, the killers may not have particularly much in common with them, but they all have like a root in like the sort of anxieties of the time, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And be that kind of issues around kind of gender or class or just the fact that he fucking hates cops, you know, like whatever it is. I think evil always has a really big context within Hitchcock. And yeah, over the course of his career, you can see how that context shifts.
Mm. That feels like a good point to move on to Frenzy, which would be Hitchcock's penultimate film in 1972. And I wonder if actually we start the other way around with this one. You know, how do you think, considering how much more was allowed to exist on screen by this time in the 70s in cinema, both in America and in the UK, how does this fit or update or, you know, make a bit more extreme the figure of the Hitchcock thriller or the Hitchcock killer?
Well, I think at this point in his career, there'd been an idea that he'd sort of lost a bit of his bite. I don't think he'd really had like a properly acclaimed film since Marnie, which is, I mean, like more than a decade prior, which is, when you're putting out a film a year, is actually quite a rubbish run. To me, this is sort of Hitchcock's final hurrah, and I'm so excited that you got to watch it for the first time for the podcast, because what a nasty, pervy, horrible, wonderful little film this is.
Yeah.
To me, it feels very confessional watching it.
Oh.
Somebody coming to the end of their career, realizing the way in which they've sort of snuck their way into women's lives in professional situations and committed violence against them. I think it might be his nastiest film. And to be genuinely like the most terrifying film, or the terrifying scene maybe in all of Hitchcock, is when our protagonist's ex-wife ends up trapped in a room with a killer, and it's sort of slowly unveiled that, you know, just how dangerous this situation is.
Yeah.
But also, you know, as much as so much of Hitchcock's beliefs were loathsome, love that he hates cops again in this movie.
There is, and you're right, this was my first time watching Frenzy. And I think I sort of always stayed away from it for two reasons. One, because I mean, I've been living in London for a while now, but somehow I didn't want to watch it until I felt like I lived in London, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And also I had heard and read how aggressive and nasty it is. And I've watched a lot of nasty shit, but there is an ickiness to this film that really, I really felt like taking a shower after watching it. I've seen a
lot. Well, the violence is so sexual,
I think, so as well. It's so sexual. It's so... trying to find a way to describe it, because it's not to say it's not a good film, but it does feel like almost Hitchcock unleashed, you know, that now the rules that had kind of kept his filmmaking, his images in check for decades had fallen apart, had fallen away. You know, it was a different kind of industry. We were seeing films like even in the two years, both in 72 when this film came out and the previous year, we had A Clockwork Orange, we had Straw Dogs, we had The Last House on the Left. They're really violent films. And a kind of violence that really sticks to your skin and makes you feel icky in a really deep-seated way. And that scene with the ex-wife, especially while she's trying to handle Rusk, and we know what's going to happen because this scene has played out many times, and the way that the camera, I know they use body doubles, but the way that the camera zoom keeps, it does these really tight close-ups on her flesh as she's being assaulted, as she's being murdered, it felt, I know that giallo is very violent, but that's so stylized. You can really remove yourself from the humanity of the characters because they're barely characters to begin with. They're really, like, the blood is way too bright and it's very obviously dummies, not real people. This feels so close up that it felt very gruesome and sort of leery.
Oh, anyone who has the lightest potential of a revisited trauma around sexual assault should give this, you know, set fire to this Blu-ray and for the love of God, never watch it. But I think Anna Massey it's Barbara Lee Hunt.
Yeah.
Who's playing Brenda. You know, a professional woman, a psychologist who's essentially trying to counsel someone only to discover she sort of, almost by like her kindness and by her professionalism, locked in a room with the most dangerous person possible. It sort of speaks to such a great fear where like women are conditioned to sort of move past their own discomfort to accommodate the needs of men. And I think in this case, what I love about her performance is that you just see her dissociate.
Mm.
You see her knowing that all she can do is try and be there as little as possible.
Yeah.
And it's devastating.
It's sort of devastating as well in the previous scene when she goes out for dinner with her ex-husband, our kind of innocent man who people think is the actual killer committing the murders, this former RAF leader who really is a forgettable character. There is really not that much to him except that he's a bit of a hothead and a bit of a dick, and he is also just a massive dick to his ex-wife, and she also kind of manages him and takes pity on him and gives him money and takes him out to dinner on her dime, even though he bursts into her office and kind of just yells at her for absolutely no reason. I wonder kind of how do you think, because are the killer in this film, Bob Rusk, and the lead are buddies. Like how, and Hitchcock, you know, has always played around with doubles and with kind of the wronged innocent man. How do you think that dynamic deploys in Frenzy?
I suppose it kind of goes back to the two previous films in that sort of acceptable face of the psychopath and how much you can get away with if you're sort of still presenting something that is fine to like other men. But watching Frenzy, the thing that, sorry, not to make every movie about me, but I just remember being at university and having, you know, good male friends who were like nice guys, decent people. And the sort of behavior that they would tolerate from their friends. And I'd end up in screaming matches with them where I'm just like, how can you allow your friend? This is your friend. You're inviting them out all of the time. I've just seen them basically walk a woman out of this pub that is so drunk that she can't consent. And I'm like running to get a new, and that's your friend. Like there's an element of men just not seeing the red flags that are so glaringly obvious to women, but then women are conditioned to pretend they don't notice because, you know, like the men have told us that we're just being like hysterical. I don't know. I don't even know that I can credit so much of this stuff to Hitchcock, because it's not like he had like the most nuanced ideas around like femininity, but I think he at least tapped into something that's like very dark and very true.
And what do you think of Rusk as, not as a killer, but he does, at least until we see his real face, present as a kind of prototype for the quote-unquote nice guy villain, because he is very matey-matey and very approachable and in a superficial kind of pub friends kind of way.
Yeah, he's got that kind of, I suppose, superficial level of charm. He's got like an obnoxiousness to him and a shallowness to him that I think only exists under the patriarchy. Like, I don't think a woman like that could be beloved and mean like there's hints of something that's off with him, I think, early on, just even like the cadence of his language and stuff. It's you know, and it's for saying that, like, you know, something the director of Psycho to be like, this is when he fully embraced darkness. This is a much more disturbing film than I think anything in his oeuvre. And I love it. And I love the Covent Garden of it. And I love that, like, it's horrible and it's true. And, you know me, Anna, I'm a food person. I used to work in food. And, like, just that the detective's wife has sort of become a very pretentious cook on her, like, cooking course is the most delightful detail. And you expect her to be... You expect the power dynamic between them to be quite different. You expect like her to be like desperate to please and he hasn't mentioned it. And instead the sort of like twist is that she's like, I don't give a fuck if you like it. Like I'm like expanding my cultural horizons and like cooking to the best of my ability. It's such like a nice little, you know, like it takes the weight off you when you're watching this film, because it's a really dark thing to contemplate, I think, otherwise.
Yeah, it's a real kind of comedic palate cleanser, that little subplot of the wife cooking very gray food. Everything is gray, brown. Even, you know, as she's describing these recipes, I was thinking, this is not supposed to be this color, I don't think.
It was the 70s.
But do you, and you know, you mentioned Covent Garden, but this is a very London film. How do you think London is portrayed in this film?
I think it's a London that doesn't exist anymore. The idea of those sort of intermingling classes doesn't really happen anymore. This Covent Garden area, I mean, just generally central London has become a concern of the uber wealthy elite. and God, I don't want to say like London lost something, because in this case, I'd be like, we've lost our working class serial killers. But yeah, there's a flavor to it, which you kind of can't help but feel nostalgic for when you watch all of the, like, you know, beautiful Georgian architecture around Covent Garden and all the fruit that's just being sold for, like, you know, five a penny. It's gorgeous. But then I suppose, not to tie everything back to everything else, but, you know, it's a bit like his early vision of Americana. Like, you can be charmed by the surface, but there's some fucked up stuff happening just if you kind of peek around the corner.
Mm. I do wonder, though, I was watching it and I was thinking, actually, oh my God, I felt the opposite of nostalgia. I felt almost like repelled by this very... I wonder if this is to do with the fact that he was at the end of his career, the end of his life, and kind of that confessional element that you were talking about earlier, almost this unleashing of the kind of movies that he wished he was allowed to make for most of his career. And sometimes for artists or for creatives, the boundaries imposed by either money or whatever other kind of constraints are imposed are a blessing, because they force them to clarify what it is they're making. And I'm talking about this kind of very generally. And watching this film, I'm like, everything is brown, dark, sweaty, and it feels like the nastiness almost projected, the nastiness of the film and the subject matter and Rusk as a killer projecting itself onto the London. Like, he was filming a London that was almost cinematically violent. You know, like, he was not interested in the people who were just living their lives and buying the fruit that was being sold in Covent Garden. It was more like, no, everyone here is gross and suspect.
Okay, I'm going to say something that might get me cancelled.
Go on.
Don't you think... So, you know, you and I were used to this experience of, like, having to see the white, cis, often privileged view of the world. Like, I lived in Notting Hill for 15 years, then I watched the film Notting Hill, and I see it the way that Richard Curtis, I believe, sincerely sees it, but it's not in line with my experience. Now I'm thinking, maybe what I love about Frenzy is because somehow this, like, late 70s auteur, incredibly wealthy white English man came to view London as I experience it, where it feels dangerous, it feels disquieting, it feels that, like, people, like, you're not fully speaking the same language as other people, and a bit foreign, and just, like, at risk, and that your methods of recourse, be it the Met, be it just kind of good expectations from your fellow man, cannot be relied upon. I'm not saying that Hitchcock made London from the perspective of a black woman, but I'm not saying that.
There is something very depressing and also cynical about that. I get it. I get where you're coming from. And I can see it. And I think I can see it also, particularly in the way that the bodies of the women and the victims are filmed and displayed. You know, this horrible, gruesome scene where I think is it Anna Massey's Babs, when she gets murdered, and Rusk has to go find her body again and retrieve this this pin that she grabbed onto as he was killing her. We see this like naked, lifeless body fall out of a sack of potatoes. And I found that really, really distressing. You know, Hitchcock's done so many violent films and has given us so many psychopaths that have endured in pop culture since they first saw the screen. But we were never exposed to this amount of just casual dumping of bodies. I don't know if there's something about the fact of, because he is Hitchcock, he's not, at this point in his career, he wasn't this up and coming, you know, murder movie maker. It was like, this is what you always wanted to show?
I didn't, because I felt that he presents that as being so disgusting that what he's almost showing is not that Babs is worthless or deserves that, but more of like how someone like Babs, I suppose, is treated. Again, I'm probably projecting, to be fair.
We're probably but both like, are.
I remember walking home all the time, you know, single woman of color, and you know, I'm living alone, and you know, it's not that anything bad happened to me, but I would just have occasionally this thought of like, would anyone give a shit? I don't think I'd make the headlines. How long till someone noticed? Those dark thoughts that come across, like not only when you're slightly fearing for your own safety, but like the second thought is just like, and would it even matter to the community of which I'm sort of chosen to live in? And I think that's like almost the true tragedy of Babs. But again, I mean, I'm not gonna lie, I love a lot of these Hitchcock films, and I'm aware that I do mental gymnastics to make them okay.
Yeah, I think we all do. Because you have to admire the artistry and the filmmaking. But I think I've never actually felt this as acutely as I did with Frenzy, this almost stickiness of the film and this casual cynicism. Even though, you know, both Uncle Charlie in Shadow of a Doubt and both the edgelords in Rope are very cynical, misanthropic characters. But there's something about Rusk that I really, and about Frenzy, that feels particularly, I don't think voyeuristic is the right word, but in...
I think it feels self-loathing.
Yeah.
I think he's almost asking us to ask why we asked him to do this, you know, to perpetuate this. I think there's no Hitchcock film that is felt like such a confession and seemed to have like such contempt for itself. Like in almost all of these films, there's someone alive at the end to root for. There's a Jimmy Stewart that maybe sees the error of his ways, you know, in Psycho, in Lifeboat, in, you know, any of them. This, he gives us a protagonist that I don't believe we're supposed to care about. I think, you know, he's, as much as, you know, he's the man falsely accused and like the police get it wrong, we're introduced to him and we're sort of he's presented as being pretty loathsome and kind of a leech on the women, on his life and in society of his life, and at best like an observant of the true horrors around him. It's there's so little sympathy to be had in this film. They're sort of victims and violence and those that are ineffectual in the space in between. And then, of course, like a wonderful cook whose husband should be very grateful for his like duck or whatever it is that she's making.
Well, as we wrap up on that very upbeat note, is there anything else about either of these films that you wanted to mention?
I don't know. I'm worried I'm going to walk into the sea if we discuss this. I'm really glad that you saw this, because I think this is, even if you don't accept this as being like top tier Hitchcock, I think it's such intriguing Hitchcock.
Oh,
I don't think that you've done Hitchcock until you've watched Frenzy.
I do think it's top tier Hitchcock. I just think it's perhaps because I now have a relationship with this city, and I have lived here for quite a few years now, longer than I've lived anywhere else. And you know, you experience the idea of danger or the idea of these images differently when it feels closer to you than when it is a made up suburban American town that exists in black and white and on the screen only. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And on that note, sorry.
On that note,
the greatest horror story is what's happening potentially to archive.org. That is the violence that we should.
That's the real serial killer.
We are the true victims.
Thanks so much for your time, as always. Can't wait to put this one out.
Pleasure.